We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. And this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Inside the Teen Brain. This ACAM series will leave you inspired by best practice and armed with tips to transform your work. I'm Dr. Jane Gilmore, and I have a special interest in the teenage brain. From puberty to about the age of 25, the brain is in a unique state, with core drives including identity, novelty, risk, peers, respect, autonomy, and intense emotions. In each episode, we explore one of these developmental drives and answer three big questions. What's the background? So what? And now what? Today, we peer inside the teen brain to explore autonomy. This episode is called A State of Independence. Now, the first big question, what does the literature tell us? To be fulfilled as an adult, we must develop autonomy, at least according to Ryan and DC's self-determination theory. The independence brief is wide, covering emotion, cognition, and behaviour. Previously, the literature simply defined autonomy as a loss of close parental ties, but more recently, it's been considered a process of evolving relationships with connected but equivalent roles. In geopolitics, conflict often precedes a declaration of independence, and so it goes in the teenage brain. The push for independence is marked in the early teenage years with reported and observed increases in familial conflict. But conflict is not necessarily negative. Where it occurs in families that support the development of autonomy in principle, for example, giving choices, respecting ideas, that healthy debate supports psychosocial adjustment. Puberty leaves the brain marinated in pubertal hormones. Testosterone impacts neural circuits in males and females and results in a heightened sensitivity to status. Cronendahl's review note that this explains the need to be regarded as equivalent to adults in the social hierarchy. What we regard as high status is context specific. For example, in general, Tibetan monks aspire to be courteous. And Rondahl described adolescent trainee monks competing quite ruthlessly with one another, each striving to be the most polite. The environment also shapes the way autonomy develops. For example, longitudinal data show adults' perception of their peers' independence will predict expectations of their own freedoms and boundaries. Strong evidence indicates young people respond best when they're addressed in a respectful tone, contribute to their community, and develop intrinsic motivation, which in essence means I'm doing this because I want to and not because you told me to. Based on these three operating principles, evidence from Jaeger, Dweck, and many others show that to connect with young people, it ain't so much what you do as the way that you do it. We know healthy eating, fitness, smoking, bullying, education, and crime interventions are more likely to be successful if they're delivered to young people using a respectful, consultative model. So now we turn to our second big question and ask, so what? We're very lucky to have Bello Plows, a 19-year-old math student with experience of CAMS, who now advocates for young service users. This episode is a valuable chance to consult with a young person. So, Bella, I want to hear your thoughts about how we can deliver best practice in CAMS services. So, welcome to our episode. I'm going to ask you some questions, and I'm really interested to hear what your thoughts are. My first question is, what was the most positive part of your CAMS experience?
I think I've been in CAMS for 7 years, but there was lots of ups and downs, and I really tried to cling on to the ups. I think one of the biggest kind of good things about CAMS was that I felt cared for, like no matter what was going on around me in school or at home, like CAMS was the place and the people who would look after me. Like I think the fact that I have a caseworker, like I know that I've got that person to rely on, and the care coordination who they'll talk to all the different services. I think that that's really invaluable because it can be really confusing as a service user, as to who to speak to. So yeah, just having that, just knowing that that there's like one person there was really good.
So I mean, you talked about that one person in, having a very sort of practical support in terms of, translating all the different services and perhaps the vocabulary and so on. Was there anything about that person in particular that helped? In other words, the context of your relationship, or was it the practical support that they offered, do you think that was most valuable?
Well, so I've a certain caseworker comes to mind, and she spent quite a long time kind of at the start of our sessions, building up a relationship, learning about me, you know, who I am, like what my childhood was like, who my family are, and just like really showing that she cared about me. I think one of the ways that she showed that she kind of understood me was she adapted to her style of working. And she was very visual, and we'd write things down. And so, like, for example, at the start, we created a timeline of like my childhood, but like she used like this like big paper and colourful pens. But when she used the different colour pens, she always asked me, Bella, what colour would suit this, like, and it wasn't her leading it, she facilitated me leading the sessions, and I thought that really empowered me and that really helped me.
I mean, that's so articulately described. So the idea that she was sort of a mouthpiece for you, but it was driven by you, is really interesting. And it figures with, what we know about the best way to connect with young people, about giving them a sense of agency and advocacy. So I'm really interested to hear that. One of the things that we know is that lots of time is spent on waiting lists, and lots of young people and families are on waiting lists for a long time. Have you got any ideas about what sort of support was useful or would be useful, while families are on waiting lists?
Yeah, so I think one of the most important things about when you're on a waiting list is knowing where you are on that waiting list. I think a lot of the time you kind of feel forgotten about. It's like you've ticked that box, I'm on the waiting list, great. But actually, like having maybe a call every 6 weeks or something like that with somebody just to be able to say, okay, we've not forgotten about you're still on our list, and you know we're hoping to get to you as soon as possible. So I think that regular contact about updating is really important, but also the regular contact to be able to have that safe space to talk. And like just because you're on the list now to go to get help doesn't mean that your problems are just going to disappear. So I think still having that ability to speak to someone, even though it's only it doesn't have to be a long phone call, but it's really important. And I think also seeing what there is around in the community, as like that can kind of fill that void of CAMHS, for in the meantime, like social prescribing, and is there any arts clubs around, just something to help them in the meantime. And then also still having access to the like materials like DBT skills, or still having access to what they might be able to learn in therapy. Because like for me, whilst I was waiting, I was going on websites and like looking at different like CBT kind of things just so that I wasn't just deteriorating. I had something to focus on, and I could still be learning whilst I waited.
I mean, that's such a proactive and smart idea. It's almost like pre-reading for a course. So you were investigating some of the skills that you might be using in therapy. Was that your idea, or was that something that the service suggested to you?
It was my idea, because I'm quite a inquisitive person, and I need to know exactly what's going on and what's going to happen. And so having all that time to wait kind of allowed me to explore, oh, they do this or they do this, like, and actually I started to once I got to the service, then I was like, oh, this is what I need, because I'd already kind of checked out everything. But yeah, it was me and my family kind of worked together on it.
I mean, that really makes me think that something services could do would be to provide a list of good websites and appropriate material, because the web, the internet is an amazing place, but it has an amazing amount of, inaccurate and information that might not be helpful. So one thing might be useful for families is to have a sort of suggested reading list, a suggested place to look and think about some material before, before coming to the service and hit the ground running. So I think that's a brilliant idea. And your idea of engaging in what the community can offer is also really important. And we know that peer support is very useful. It has validated benefits. So it's also about finding out what's in the community, and that one of the things that we do know is around the country, community support is very patchy. Not everybody has the same experience, but again, services could potentially let families know about those while they're on the waiting list. Bella, I think you're going to have to get involved in some political or professional planning as you become older, because you've got some ideas that I think need to be rolled out in a more specific way.
I have so many ideas, but I don't know where to turn and tell them and get them done.
Well, this is number one. This is step number one, and we're hoping that this is, as an opportunity of somebody who's had the experience and will have some really interesting ideas to share, and that can perhaps be explored in a more systematic way across different services. So I want to ask again some for more of your ideas, and I want to ask you if we were sort of had a professional in mind who was trying to engage a young person in services. Perhaps they were a bit cautious, they weren't sure if they wanted to come to the service. What advice could you give that professional?
I think one of the key things is be patient. You can't rush the young person. The more you push them, the more they'll push back. So I think they'll engage when they're able to engage, but there's obviously things that you can do in the meantime to help them engage. I think one of the most important things that I found to relieve my anxieties around going to services was like getting information about who I'm going to be seeing. Let me see a photo. Let me see a description of your job, what you do. Like, I want to know your hobbies. Like, because if I know who I'm going to go and see, it takes away one more barrier of, oh my God, who is this person? I think one of the ways that professionals can help as well is talk to them about how you can help. Like, talk to them about what your intention is, like what do you see sessions looking like, and show them that actually these are my ideas as a professional, but it's going to be led by you. Reassure them that it's they're there, well, the child or young person is there to get better, and that's all the professional wants is to help them. So I think just reassuring them that the young person's interest is what's at heart. I think as well, like if they're cautious about coming into the building, can the professional go to their home, go to a place of safety like school? If the young person doesn't want to speak about how they feel, is there alternative methods of communication? Can you write to each other? Can you draw? Can you play with toys? But I think there's lots going on in that child or young person's mind, and just taking the time to understand why don't you want to engage, and you go from there. But just trying to listen to the young person is most important.
And that idea there about demystifying what a session would look like, what the building would look like, is a really straightforward and simple idea, but it would be very effective, particularly for people who haven't been in the CAMHS building before, who've never been to a therapeutic session. And so you are letting them, process a lot of the new information before they come into the session. And it's very easily done. It could be sent out, systematically. It could be on the website. There could be a journey from the front door to the therapy room. There could be lots of ways of letting young people see what it would be like, maybe even hearing the voice of the therapists on the website and so on. It's a really important idea, and I can imagine, particularly for young people who are autistic, that would be very valuable. But for everybody who is getting the idea of a therapeutic session, to settle that idea, as it were, I think that's really nice. I also like the idea of different ways of communicating. It's really important. It doesn't matter whether it's verbally, or it doesn't matter whether it's, it could be in lots of different forums, drawing, or by any means necessary. I think that's brilliant. What about if we turn this round a little bit and say, well, what about what advice would you give the young person themselves? What would you tell them if they were cautious about attending?
Well, I tell them be brave. Whatever you're thinking, it can be solved. CAMHS are there to help them. You don't have to say or do anything you don't want to say or do, and your CAMHS worker will listen to you and find out what will make you the most comfortable. And if you want to bring in anything that will make you feel better, like fidget toys, that's, you're more than welcome to. I think the reason CAMHS are involved is because things might not be going too well, and there's no harm in trying something new to try and make things better. I just think, things can be difficult, but CAMHS are there to try and help. So I would just close your eyes and do it. Feel the fear and do it anyway.
That's brilliant. And I think I wish we could bottle you, Bella, and say this is something that we could offer young people. Just hearing that advice as somebody who's been through the process and has, come out the other side doing so well in life, that is a wonderful piece of advice. But hearing it from another young person is much more valuable, we know, from than hearing it from somebody that's older and perhaps a little bit less relatable. So it's really, yeah, that's fantastic. Okay, so let's think about what would you change about CAMHS services? Now, obviously, different CAMHS services are delivered in different ways, but from your experience, what would you change?
I think it's difficult really, because you kind of just want to wave a magic wand and, change everything. But the reality is that, the services are underfunded, understaffed, under-resourced, but there are little things that can be done. Like more structure. Like, I would go for appointments week after week, and it would just be like, hi. We'd have a rant about the last week, and then I'd go. But what I found when I got given a 16-week, like, this is the therapy that we're going to do, this is how it starts, this is how it ends, like having that clear expectation of this is what's going to happen was really beneficial to me, because I had clear goals. And I think, goals are something that is pushed in CAMHS. They, like, caseworkers know how essential they are, because you always got to be working to something, but I think sometimes they can be forgotten. So just making sure that goals are always set, and there's clear expectations. I think because of the high turnover of staff in CAMHS, there's a lack of continuity of care. So I think one of the things that CAMHS needs to really focus on is looking after their staff, because only when the staff are happy and want to be there is when they're going to provide the best care possible. And as a young person accessing the service, I want to know that I'm not wasting anyone's time, and I want to know that, like, the CAMHS worker wants to be there. So I think, and because then when a CAMHS worker leaves, then you've got to transfer that caseload onto a new worker, and it's just a lot of disruption for children and young people. So, and one of the biggest things that I'd change about CAMHS is I'd up the age to 25, because the brain doesn't stop developing when you're 18. It's still developing till I think it's 25. And so what I've been finding, like being a 19-year-old now, is it's the most chaotic time of your life. Like, you when you go from primary school to secondary, secondary to college, college to university, university to a job, like, so many things happen. And I think having CAMHS changing when you're 18 is just another thing thrown in the mix that doesn't need to happen, because I found that really challenging. Because, yeah, I just think that just because you reach a certain age doesn't mean that's it, goodbye.
Absolutely. And Bella, you're absolutely right. And again, it's a good indication of how on the ball you are. We know that we talk about the teenage brain in the medical and psychological literature, and actually what we're talking about is brain development up until the age of 25. And so that period of transition, when you're moving, and sometimes young people are moving out of home into college, there's a lot of change and stress. And so keeping that continuity, particularly, with their mental health support team, would be absolutely, fundamental. And so it's something that I think there will be a lot of professionals nodding their head when you said, let's not say it's you get to 18 and it's goodbye. It should be a transition that's gradual. So it's really valuable, and you are describing it, with such a high level of capacity and being so articulate. It really helps paint a vivid picture. The other thing that really strikes me is that you talked about the relationship you had with your key worker, and it wasn't just what they did in terms of practical support, it was the relationship that you forged. And so that continuity of care is so important, and maintaining, the staff team as much as one can is a really important point. I think, Bella, you should be health secretary. And I'm no doubt you will be in a few years. Okay, so we're going to turn to our final question. And the question is now what? So, Bella, we need just one simple tip for professionals working with young people. Now, you've given us a lot of good stuff already, but what would you add? What would you leave us with as one thing to consider? One way perhaps to change a service or add to our service?
I think be consistent, and if you make a promise, keep that promise, and make sure that you know that you can't actually carry out that promise before you promise it. Because having children and young people waiting and expecting you to do something and you don't do it, it's just another blow, and we don't need any more issues.
Well said. Okay, Bella, we